to see how I do the same thing. Are we live? There we go. I'm here. Aha, we showed this one before. You remember seeing this one? Oh no, maybe not. If you stare at the this part right through here for about 30 seconds. And look at the ceiling. Or look off somewhere. You should be able to see like a white circle, and if you look in the circle, you will see Jesus. That's the right Clint Eastlander, right? Once you see it, you'll know you saw it. That makes sense? Anybody yet? One, two, three, four, five. Okay. Yeah, fun? Fun, fun. I just wanted to make sure that when you came to church today, you saw Jesus. That's what it's all about, right? Make sure we see Jesus. All right, we can try it again another time. This is a funny picture, just starting with something funny. Problem with not as many trees. I don't know, sign of patience or something. Silliness, right? Cleverness. You need a grill. You tell this guy, you got a flat tire, he takes the tire off and just puts a go-kart underneath there. Or a wagon. I like that. Duct tape's always good for everything. You like your old mailbox? Duct tape in a plastic container. I think we had this one in Mexico. I don't know if any of you guys went on a missions trip with us in Mexico when church went. A 2-liter bottle becomes your sprinkler. That was fun. Someone steals your front tire, there's what you can do instead, right? Hot dog roast. Air conditioning. Put a gas compressor on the back of your vehicle and hook it up. That's great. So how's your day going? I don't know if you can see, it's convertible, followed porta-pots. And if you can see from the picture's not as clear right there, but with the lighting in here, but the bridge is a little bit too low. All right. We've been going through 1 Samuel. Had a funny situation last week. I shared with Dr. Joel already, but last week I was speaking at my home church down Hazel Park and started taking them. I've been a little bit through 1 Samuel with them when I'm there from time to time. And I was going to 1 Samuel and there was probably about 30 people in the Sunday school class, and mainly women and old and older. My wife was the youngest one there. Then we have a friend that we've known for years who's about 54, and then everybody's 65 and older. And I don't know how old some of them are. We'd have to do some carbon dating, but old, okay? And the one lady's up front. There's two ladies in the front row here and then one lady over here, and they're sitting in the pews, and I have a music stand like this, and I start reading from 1 Samuel, and my notes are New International Version, NIV. If you're familiar with different Bible translations than that, but the church is now, not when I was raised there, but now they're more of a KJV, King James Version. And so they often want me to speak. Well, they contacted me on a Thursday night, and I had been sick, and so it was like a couple days, so I thought, I'm not going to change my notes over. We're going NIV. And I start off, and this lady up front goes, I can't follow along. And I'm like, okay, yeah, I know. I'm using NIV and not King James Version, but you'll get it if you go. So I start reading again, and she's like, it's not even close. And she sets her Bible down. And this lady says, well, just listen, follow along. If he's saying it, you know it's true, which was quite a compliment coming from, you know, people who've known me my whole life, right? And so I just keep sharing from it. I start reading again later, and she's going, and she sets her Bible down. She starts talking to the lady next to her. I don't know how much you're around people who are in their 80s, but their whisper voice is a little bit louder than their normal voice. And she starts whispering to her this kind of thing. Well, she tells her just to let it go in a gentle argumentative voice. And about five rows back is a lady who is blind. Blind from birth. She just retired recently and has been an amazing, amazing lady. As a matter of fact, in the service that morning, she was special music. But she says, well, if you can't hear them, why don't you sit in the front row? The lady is in the front row. So just, it becomes funny. So as soon as I finish just the Sunday school time, and it's not even the church yet, right? The Sunday school time, she stands up immediately, opens up her Bible, shows it to me, and she says, first of all, now, as soon as someone says like that, you know some attitude's coming, right? She goes, first of all, there isn't a first Daniel. We just call it Daniel. And I said, oh, okay. But we were in 1 Samuel. And I could see from your Bible you were too far into it, but I didn't want to embarrass you in front of everybody. She goes, oh, well, there's only one Daniel. I said, okay. You're right. So we're in 1 Samuel, right? Are you good with this? But here are some phrases that we're going to go through in this chapter. We're chapter 19, believe it or not. But it says, go into hiding, eluded, made good his escape, run for your life, fled and escaped, get away, fled and made his escape. Not phrases we normally think of with David. This is our hero. This is the David of David and Goliath. This is the David that unsaved people know about, that we always hear about the David and Goliath stories, right? And whether someone accepts the Bible or not, they know that story, and they'll refer to it often in March Madness with sports and when you have your different teams and one is so much larger than the other and the underdog comes through. And here you have a situation where David goes on the run. And in this chapter, David trusts in three different individuals. And I'm wondering, and I'm not going to be dogmatic about something or come down on this is what I think has happened. Just something to think about. David's problems are a lot of them that he's trusting in people at this time, when he should be trusting in God. Or is it he is trusting in God and we do need to work with people? That it is good to let people help us. You know, all too often we have a difficult time allowing others to help us. And we just want to do it ourselves. We know if we want it done right, we'll do it ourselves. And so to let other people help us, we're willing to help others. But for somebody to help me could show a sign of weakness. And I don't want that. And so I don't mean to be difficult with David, but I just want to think through it a little bit as we go into this. It's a lot about loyalty in this section. You're going to find that from a dear friend as he goes into this, on how loyal a friend could be. First of all, David's going to put his trust in Jonathan. Jonathan is Saul's son. Saul is the king. Saul at one time really enjoyed David and appreciated all he was doing, and then gets to a point where he is intimidated by David. The whole idea of trust, have you ever done a trust fall? Who's ever done that before? Have you ever seen it where it didn't work? You ever seen the movie Mean Girls? Yeah, that's a fun one. Okay. At my weight, we don't do these kinds of things. 1 Samuel chapter 19, verses 1 through 3. Saul told his son Jonathan and all the attendants to kill David. But Jonathan was very fond of David and warned him, "My father Saul is looking for a chance to kill you. Be on your guard tomorrow morning. Go into hiding and stay there. I will go out and stand with my father in the field where you are. I'll speak to him about you and will tell you what I find out." I don't know if you recall from the story earlier, but Saul was willing to give away his daughter to the man who would kill Goliath. Saul's in a situation now where he wants to kill his son-in-law. His own son, Jonathan, says he's heard about this, is warning David because he cares so much about David. David's to be the next king, which is not natural to other nations. They wanted a king like other nations, and other nations, their king, when he died, his son automatically became the king. And so it would be a case for Jonathan's to be the next king, but he does not have a problem with David being the next one, and is supportive of David and very faithful to him, even to the extent where he's more faithful to him than he is to his own father when it comes to what is right and wrong. Verses 4 and 5. Jonathan spoke well of David to Saul his father and said to him, "Let not the king do wrong to his servant David. He has not wronged you. And what has he done? And what he has done has benefited you greatly. He took his life in his hands when he killed the Philistine. The Lord won a great victory for all Israel, and you saw it and were glad. Why then would you do wrong to an innocent man like David by killing him for no reason?" He takes him back, and whenever he refers to the Philistine, it's talking about Goliath. And he's just reminding him that he's done great things, but then he also, Jonathan very astutely points out, it's the Lord who won the great victory. You know, it's kind of like, let's take it off ourselves. Who's it supposed to be about? It's supposed to be about God. It's not about us. And so here's Jonathan talking to his dad saying, focus on God. It's not between you and David. Verse 6 or 8. Saul listened to Jonathan and took this oath. As surely as the Lord lives, David will not be put to death. So Jonathan called David and told him the whole conversation. He brought him to Saul, and David was with Saul as before. Once more, war broke out, and David went out and fought the Philistines. He struck them with such force that they fled before him. And so you have the whole situation where Jonathan talks to his father. His father says, "You know what? You're right. I make a promise to you. I will not have him killed." And so David's able to come back into the house as before. In a normal situation, was in the house before, he would eat with him. And matter of fact, when Saul was having difficulties, he would play the harp for him, play music for him, and calm him down. And they even have a situation where a military crisis comes up again with the Philistines, and David goes in to lead the battle. Where David is now, I would believe, at such celebrity status that if he wanted to stay back, he could and send someone else. He doesn't have to go in to lead the battle, but he chooses to lead the battle. Verses 9 and 10. But an evil spirit from the Lord came upon Saul as he was sitting in his house with a spear in his hand. While David was playing the harp, Saul tried to pin him to the wall with his spear. But David eluded him as Saul drove the spear into the wall. That night, David made good his escape. I think it's just a situation again. An evil spirit from the Lord came upon Saul. And we have a lot of times in throughout Scripture where we'll have God hardening the heart of Pharaoh. And you'll have God actively involved. And it may not fit into our comfortable theological grid that God is involved in the lives of people and directly coming in, and he's not pleased with who Saul is, and an evil spirit from the Lord came upon him, an evil spirit that the Lord allowed to come upon him. However you want to view that, is a situation where personality-wise, but also spiritually, Saul snaps. And he goes after David. and he grabs his spear. And I don't know what the distance is. I don't think it's this distance, because Saul is a military man. But he throws a spear, and David eludes it. I don't know to what extent we think through that much. You know, if someone were to pull out a knife and throw it at you, and you, whoa, and it goes right into the wall, that would be a traumatic event. You know, they grab something, throw it, trying to kill you. Excuse my silliness for a moment, but since we drive an escape, David made his escape. Sorry. You just make sure you're paying attention with me, okay? When he takes off and leaves the situation, he leaves from Jonathan. He can't stay in the house anymore, obviously. It's not a safe situation. Michael is his wife, and so he trusts her. In verses 11 through 13, Saul sent men to David's house to watch it and to kill him in the morning. But Michal, David's wife, warned him, "If you don't run for your life tonight, tomorrow you'll be killed." So Michal let David down through a window, and he fled and escaped. Then Michal took an idol and laid it on the bed, covering it with a garment and putting some goat's hair at the head. When David takes off and goes out that window, he basically enters a 10-year time frame of exile. For the next 10 years, he now wanders. He won't be king for some time. And it's a 10-year time when he takes off there. It's interesting that his wife realized her father was wrong and supported David more than her own father. And I will tell you, I believe that's a God thing. That when you are righteous, even people who aren't righteous will support you more than they will to those closest to them. You will be blessed over it. And you have a situation here where for her to even have an idol bothers me. She should not even have had an idol in the house that she could lay there and put in a place and look like it was David there. But she has one. But even in that situation, even though she's not, in my opinion, a godly person, she knows who David is. She understands something special and different about him and supports him and helps him in the situation. An idol could be something like this. They have life-size idols. This is one I was looking back through some, Googling through, trying to figure an idea of what would be laid there. And so she puts that there. In verses 14 through 17, we read, "When Saul sent men to capture David, Michal said, 'He is ill.' Then Saul sent the men back to see David and told them, 'Bring him up to me in his bed so I may kill him.' When the men entered, there was an idol in the bed, and at the head was some goat's hair. Saul said to Michal, 'Why do you deceive me like this and send my enemy away so that he has escaped?' Michal said, 'He said to me, "Let me get away. Why should I kill you?" You get a situation there where she's pretending that David threatened her. And it was her only way of getting away with from this is that he wouldn't kill her if this whole deception took place. And so, you know, she puts it back on him. These verses really intrigue me. Saul's men come to get David so they can kill him. But he's sick. So they back off. You only kill healthy people? I mean, what, is it like wrong? Is it like a curse? You can't kill a sick person. Wait till he gets better, then we'll kill him. I don't get that. It's humorous to me. It bought him some time. And so here you have, again, her saying, her lying to cover up for something. She lied in saying that he was sick, and then she lies in saying that about the threatening of it. Romans 3:8 says, why not say as we are being slanderously reported as saying, and as some claim that we say, let us do evil that good may result. Their condemnation is deserved. I don't think it's ever right to do wrong. We have something a phrase we use, the end doesn't justify the means. I don't think we should limit our God so much that we have to sin in order for right to come about. I think our responsibility always is strive to do the right thing. And if we walk in a blameless, pure way and let God take care of the results, that's what we're called to do. And here is the situation. What, are we supposed to do evil? A good may result? Romans will get into the whole idea of if I sin, God gives grace. And the more I sin, the more grace he gives. Should I sin all the more so he gives more and more grace? And it's like, no, that's not what that's all about. This is interesting. This is Psalm 59. In Psalm 59, for the director of music, to the tune of Do Not Destroy, we'd love to know what some of these tunes are. You know, we don't have those anywhere that we know of what they are, but it's written by David. It's Miktam. It's when Saul had sent men to watch David's house in order to kill him. What you need to realize is, you see verse 1 says, deliver me from my enemies? In the Hebrew Bible, verse 1 is for the director of music. That whole starting point. That's not something we added 1,000 years later. That is in the Hebrew Bible. So in 250 BC, when the Hebrew Old Testament was translated into Greek, it's called the Septuagint. The LXX is how they'll abbreviate sometimes, because it was 70 Jewish priests translated it, so they could have the Hebrew into Greek. That was already there. So when I say to you, the Psalm 59 talks about, it's David's feelings when the people came and Saul sent guys to kill him, it's not me being very clever and deep, deep research and years of schooling. It's me looking at verse 1 and reading it. And it's saying, when Saul had sent men to watch David's house in order to kill him. Okay? There are other parts in our Bible where that superscript or subscript kind of thing where, like, Paul goes to Rome. Those are just like a summary for us of that section. But when it comes to Psalms, we've really messed up by that, because we should really have verse 1. As a matter of fact, if you use a commentary that refers to some of the Hebrew, it might throw you off. If you go to deeper research, it might throw you off a little bit, because they always refer to verse 1 as for the director of music, and verse 2 would be deliver me from my enemies. Okay, did I make any sense there at all? Are we following a little bit? Okay, good, good. Deliver me from my enemies, O God. Protect me from those who rise up against me. Deliver me from from evildoers and save me from bloodthirsty men. See how they lie in wait for me. Fierce men conspire against me for no offense or sin of mine, O Lord. He realizes, first of all, that it's not because of his sin they're coming after him. And I'm wondering to what extent he's watching them from a distance. I have done no wrong, yet they are ready to attack me. Arise to help me. Look on my plight. O Lord God Almighty, the God of Israel, rule yourself to punish all the nations. Show no mercy to wicked traitors. Selah. Selah technically means, the literal translation of that means, look up. We're not sure with the people who would have sung this as a song, if it would have been, you know what, let's go back to that previous verse like you did earlier, and do that again, look up, meaning repeat, or if they literally paused and looked up to heaven, acknowledging God. We're not sure which of those two it is. They return at evening, snarling like dogs, and prowl about the city. See what they spew from their mouths? They spew out swords from their lips, and they say, who can hear us? But you, O Lord, laugh at them. You scoff at all those nations. O my strength, I watch for you. You, O God, are my fortress, my loving God. God will go before me and will let me gloat over those who slander me. But do not kill them, O Lord, our shield, or my people will forget. In your might, make them wander about and bring them down. For the sins of their mouths, for the words of their lips, let them be caught in their pride. For their curses and lies they utter, consume them in wrath. Consume them till they are no more. Then it will be known to the ends of the earth that God rules over Jacob. Salah. And I really appreciate the whole, there's a few more verses here, but the whole concept going through this, David doesn't want revenge on them for his own sake. It's their pride, they're going against God. And he wants them, don't destroy them, let the people realize that God is true. They return at evening, snarling like dogs and prowl about the city. They wander about for food and howl, if not satisfied. But I will sing of your strength. In the morning I will sing of your love. You are my fortress, my refuge in times of trouble. O my strength, I sing praise to you. You, O God, are my fortress, my loving God. I looked up for Google. There's an award called the Ugliest Dog Award, and that's a picture. I thought it was a beautiful picture for the snarling dogs kind of thing. But and there truly is a competition for the ugliest dog stuff. But I'm not saying that night David sat down and wrote this. He could have. He may have written this a week later, a month later. But the perspective he has, when things go bad for us, when times are difficult, when they're not going the way we expected, what is our response? When people go out to hurt us and strive to intentionally hurt us or pick on us, is our immediate response, God, you are awesome. God, you are in control. It really doesn't allow for a pity party. If anybody could have a pity party, it would be David right there. David, God, I followed you. I've done everything you've wanted, and this is how you treat me? God, I've been good to you, and you're not being good to me. I mean, silly things that we say. He doesn't say that. He says, he starts off by saying, in a way, I've examined my heart. I haven't sinned. I know I haven't sinned. This isn't happening because I sinned. So I then look to you and trust you that you have something else planned. The next section we're going to go into is David trusting Samuel in the last verses 18 through 24. It is interesting that later on, David mentions on how much he misses Jonathan, but he never mentions missing his wife. And as he goes off running now, I mean, maybe that's not funny to you, but it just intrigues me that, but again, Jonathan would have been more of a godly man, and was Michal really that godly of a person? Continue on. When David had fled, made his escape, he went to Samuel at Ramah and told him all that Saul had done to him. Then he and Samuel went to Naoth and stayed there. Word came to Saul, David is Naoth at Ramah. It's just a few miles away. Verse 20. So he sent men to capture him, but when they saw a group of prophets prophesying, when Samuel standing there as leader, the Spirit of God came upon Saul's men, and they also prophesied. Saul was told about it, and he sent more men, and they prophesied too. Saul sent men a third time, and they also prophesied. That word for prophesy could be used a couple different ways. Foretelling events is what we know the prophecy. Speaking forth the truth is another translation for prophecy. Or it could just be the singing of songs and praising God. And whatever happens, these men are sent to capture David so he can be killed. And as they get there, a revival takes place in their lives. God converts them. Their heart is changed. The Spirit challenges their heart, and they start praising God. Saul hears about it, and he sends another group of men. And the same thing happens again. He sends a third group of men. And they start worshiping, praising God. Finally, he himself left for Ramah and went to the great cistern at Sukkoth. And he asked, "Where are Samuel and David?" "Over in Naath at Ramah," they said. So Samuel went to Naath at Ramah, but the Spirit of God came up even upon him. And he walked along prophesying until he came to Naoth. He stripped off the robes and also prophesied in Samuel's presence. He lay the way all that day and night. That's why people say, "Is Saul also among the prophets?" Here you have Saul, as James 1:8 would say, is a double-minded man, unstable in all he does. I don't know if you can see, but he's schizophrenic. The guy's crazy. He's going in both directions, whatever. Something really captures me about this passage is that, again, how big is our God? Where is our focus? When people come against us, and we know it's not because we've done wrong. It's not that I've gossiped on them, or I've stabbed them in the back, and now they're coming back to get revenge. When I haven't done wrong, and they're coming at me, shouldn't my immediate response be prayer for their salvation? Do you ever get to a point where you take time to think about who God is able to save? I think we almost get too caught up in the idea of that person who's like a really moral, good person. Let's just witness to them because they're like almost already saved. They wouldn't really change their life much. And I'm not convinced that is the case. Salvation is radical in anyone. No one is like close. We're lost. And there is a hell. And we need to be saved. I often think the person who is most against Jesus Christ is closest. It's that whole concept of love and hate being so close as neighbors. And you may not understand what I'm saying right there, but just when someone hurts you that you really don't know that well or really don't care that much about, you blow it off quicker. But when someone hurts you who is close to you, it might get to a point where you hate them. A week earlier, a day, an hour earlier, you love them. It was one of your dearest friends, and now you hate them? Because love and hate can become so close. And I think the person who totally refers to themselves as an atheist and comes out totally against God really may be struggling. And the Spirit is there battling, convicting them to a point where they know they need salvation and they are so close to giving over to God. The person who comes at you, and you may not have experienced this yet, I'm guessing you probably did, but who comes against you for doing right, who mocks you for being good, who insults you for having integrity, pray for their salvation. Don't think that God can't do it. We quickly go to Scripture and say, when Saul became Paul, Saul was the one who had Stephen killed. Saul was the one who was on a road to go persecute more Christians. That's what his journey was when he radically got saved. At the moment got saved and totally changed his ways. That God is still alive. that God is still in charge. When I think with David, you know, that forgiveness is not something we do for other people. We do it for ourselves to get well and to move on. David forgives Saul regularly. David doesn't go out to try to kill him. He doesn't try to get even. And you know what? No one tries to get even. You always try to get them more than they got you. When revenge isn't getting even. Agree with that? You know, normally if it's revenge, you got to one-up them. Even if it's just words. You know, trash talking. Someone trash talks, you don't try to make it even and we're both happy. That doesn't happen. You one-up them, they one-up you, and you go back and forth. Even if it's in fun. But David doesn't go for revenge. He has a perspective that God is in charge. And just reaches out to forgive. I view it so often as people will say, if you haven't forgotten the situation, you haven't forgiven. And I don't think we need to put ourselves in that kind of guilt trip. It's not that how can I forget something? I view it as like a paper shredder, an IOU. When someone has wronged me, if I'm going to forgive them, what I need to do is take that IOU and put it in the paper shredder. It's still there, but I can never use it again. I'll never use it against them. To forgive someone, to never use that situation against them again. When you see this picture, what do you think of? It may be something cultural that's different. I don't know. It may be generationally different. If someone's crossed their fingers behind their back, you know anybody by that? Pardon? They're lying. Who understands it? Who's heard that before? You guys, you know what I'm talking about with this, okay? It becomes an interesting concept with Thomas Aquinas was a theologian, philosopher, but I won't be able to see those words very well, but he broke down deception to like three different categories. The helpful lies of necessity, those told in jest, and the malicious lies told to harm another person to save. And I don't get into this. I don't view those helpful lies. I don't see it that way. The deception, the lying, it's wrong. And I think we need to get to a point where, you know, we even know with the Ten Commandments, you know, not to bear false witness. We're very familiar with the second to bottom on the right here, that you know, we're to be honest. Proverbs 11:3, the integrity of the upright guides them, but the unfaithful are destroyed by their duplicity. You know, I've told you before about when I was in eighth grade and in a shop class, and a guy, 6'1", Paul, and I clearly remember the situation, working on a project, and there being a kill switch by the door that would stop all the power. And the reason for it was, if someone had a piece of clothing get caught into the machinery, you could at least cut the power on everything. Problem is, if you're doing something that's putting a shellac, a nice finish on your piece, if the machine stops, you still have it there, it throws stuff on it and messes it up. And I remember with Paul working on that and his best friend Brian hitting it. Lights go off for a moment, he runs over by me to hide, and the security lighting starts coming on, and Paul looks at his project and realizes it's destroyed. He's got all kinds of work he has to put back into it. In eighth grade, I wasn't 6'1 already. Take my word for it, right? You kind of believe me on that one? And I remember Paul coming over, Paul's a ninth grader, started a Class A school, Warren Fitzgerald, and I don't think it's Class A now, but it was then. He was starter as a freshman in football, basketball, and baseball for varsity. Phenomenal athlete. He set a state record in hurdles as an eighth grader. Amazing athlete. And he looks over. Who did it? And Brian's saying, Randy did it. And I went, Paul, I didn't do it. I had a philosophy growing up. I could either outrun a person, and if a person could outrun me, I could beat them up. How's that for a silly philosophy of life? And it was accurate. Not with Paul. Paul was one who could outrun me and he could beat me up. And I remember him coming over and I said, Paul, I didn't do it. I'm not going to try to run. I'm done. And then coming over and immediately punching Brian, his best friend. And Brian goes, what? And he goes, Randy's never lied to me. I know you're a liar. His best friend, he knows the liar. They're best friends. Not that I was perfect. Not that I never lied. But here was a situation where the integrity of the upright guides them, but the unfaithful are destroyed by their duplicity. Be one who's known for being honest. Can I stereotype for a moment? There's a better chance that if you're in class and people have a chance to sit next to somebody who they haven't prepared for a test, they're going to look at you as already knowing the information. Fair statement? I'm not saying you do know it. But if they're not ready and they have a chance to sit next to somebody and cheat, they'll probably choose you over me. Fair statement? Be one who's known for integrity. I think that the one cheating and the one who allows the cheating are both wrong. I'm not calling you to do something that's easy. It's the funny thing about it. The Christian life isn't a simple life. Like an easy life. We're called to be different. It's amazing on how often people want to be radical. We have something in our school right now that's going on. And I talked to one of the boys. We're a uniform school at Oakland Christian. Regularly on Fridays we get to wear jeans. If we pay a couple bucks and it goes to some kind of fund or something. And a couple of the boys are trying to like wear other pants that look like the school pants. And it's becoming their game. So Friday, I sat down next to one of the guys, and I'm like, did you pay for a jean set? He's wearing, it looks like khaki pants, but they're a khaki jean. I said, did you pay for a jean set? He goes, yes. And he had a stamp on. I said, good. I said, because I know you're playing this game, the senior boy, of trying to be radical by breaking the dress code. You know, there's a major goal in life for you. And I said, why don't you be radical by doing what's right? Be radically saved. Be radical in knowing of integrity. And I will tell you, people will appreciate it. And people you don't think like you will respect you for it. And may even come back to you asking for help in the area. You belong to your father, the devil, and you want to carry out your father's desire. He was a murderer from the beginning, not holding to the truth, for there is no truth in him. When he lies, he speaks his native language, for he's a liar and the father of lies. I'd be pretty harsh about Satan. What do you think? You know, saying something about someone like that. Ephesians 4:25 says, therefore each of you must put off falsehood and speak truthfully to his neighbor, for we are all members of one body. And I know as I'm trying to put that up there, you're trying to read what's behind it, so I'm But you see what it was? Satan was here. I think when we lie, it's kind of like Satan was here. Now you have that of knowing what the background is. Let's go back to the verse. Therefore, each of you must put off falsehood and speak truthfully to his neighbor, for we're all members of one body. As you know, I'm involved in a silly sport called golf. It's amazing, though, being a gentleman's sport. I don't know of another sport where you call fouls on yourself. I do know that it wouldn't work well in the NBA, because every time I see someone get called for a foul, they argue it. It seems like every time there's a foul or penalty called, people argue. And in golf, we call on ourselves. It's a gentleman's sport. It's supposed to be a sport of integrity. I'm not saying it always is. I heard of a situation recently, and it became a difficult one for the guy to know what to do with this one. They're getting down to the last hole, and they're tied. It's the 18th hole. And the one guy hits his drive right into the fairway. The other guy hits his into the woods. And so they go over into the woods to find the guy's ball. He's allowed 5 minutes. If he can't find it, it's a penalty. He has to go back and hit again. And they're going through there, and the guy says, you know what? Go ahead and hit your shot. I'm just going to take another minute. If I can't find mine, then I'll just take the penalty. The guy says, okay, and he goes to the fairway, hits a great shot onto the green, about 8 feet away from the pin. Nice shot. He's putting for birdie. Right then as he hits, he hears a guy hit something out of the woods, saying he found his ball, and he puts it. And the story is told, just like 8 inches away from the cup. And he wants to say, I know the guy didn't find his ball. Can you challenge him on cheating? And you know why he knows the guy didn't find his ball? Because he has it in his pocket. When they were looking for the ball, he found it and put it in his pocket, so the other guy would have to take a penalty. And so he was cheating, so the other guy cheats, and he knows the guy cheated because he cheated to make the other. Is that a silly game of integrity? Are we honest? Are we truthful? I start off with saying there's a lot of loyalty here. You have Jonathan more loyal to his friend than to his father. You have Michal, or whatever her, I don't even pronounce her name, be more loyal to her husband David than to her father. And then I'm closing off with truthfulness, and I really believe the two go together. That loyalty and truthfulness, that truthfulness is loyalty to God. And I'm at a point in my life where I'm going to be so loyal to God that even if people are upset for me for being truthful and being honest, but that's okay, because my goal is to please Him. Let's pray.